Hello, you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, May 4th. I'm Grace from Drake University. Here is our first story. Iowa reports 528 new COVID-19 cases as the state total passes 9,000. Page County reports ninth case by Mike Brownlee, updated May 3rd. The Iowa Department of Public Health said Sunday it had been notified of 528 additional positive cases of COVID-19. Additionally, Page County reported its ninth case, bringing the state total to at least 9,170 cases. Page County Public Health said the new case is an adult between 18 and 40 years old who contracted COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus, via community spread. The individual is currently at home in isolation. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported 9 additional deaths for a total of 184 in the state. There were an additional 2,932 negative tests for a total of 44,017 negative tests to date, which includes testing reported by the state hygienic lab and other labs. The state said 77% of the new positive cases are in the 22 counties where more stringent mitigation restrictions remain in place. The state has eased restrictions in 77 Iowa counties, including Pottawatomie County and much of western Iowa. In Iowa, 378 COVID-19 patients are currently hospitalized, and 3,325 Iowans have recovered. 1 in 59 Iowans have been tested. According to the IDPH, the additional 9 deaths were reported in the following counties: Black Hawk County, 2 elderly adults, 81+. Bremer County, 1 elderly adult, 81+. Dallas County, one older adult, 61 to 80 years old. Dubuque, 1 older adult, 60 to 80 years old. Polk County, 1 older adult, 61 to 80 years old. And Poweshiek County, with 2 elderly adults, 81+. Refugees have land to be farmers again in new Lutheran Family Services program by Margie Ducey, May 3rd. Kate Cahy knows just how hard it is to get into farming. If you are just coming to this country or you are not a multi-generation farmer, it's nearly impossible, she said. That's why she's passionate about Global Roots, a new program with Lutheran Family Services of Nebraska. 32-year-old Cahy, who has been farming for 8 years on rental property, is working with several refugee families who want to get back into farming themselves. With the help of a grant, Global Roots is helping them gain access to land, equipment, and materials, and then a market where they can sell their crops. More than 30 refugees have signed up, and 12 have already started planting on lots in North Omaha. The project has been slowed by the coronavirus pandemic. Each week, more and more will be able to come and plant, Cahy said. We're working closely and collaborating with other urban agriculture organizations here in town. The refugees from all over the world know how to farm, but are learning to work with different soil, weather, and safety protocols. We want them to grow the crops that are part of their own culture, Cahy said. A lot of times they don't have access to these foods. Favorite crops are eggplant, hot peppers, cucumbers, beans, basil, cabbage, okra, pumpkin, and squash. The focus so far has been on planting, but they will also figure out ways to sell what they grow, even perhaps with small neighborhood-based markets. It was a way different farming in my home country than here, Kareni refugee Neme said. I feel satisfied growing a farm here again, and I'm not sure about selling items from the garden, but if I grew good, I would like to sell at the farm stand. She wants to feed her family too. Cahy said it's familiar with both the growing and selling from her Mullen Hill farm outside of Mondamin. She didn't have any connections when she started and says farmer-to-farmer support is best. I would not have been able to start without other experienced farmers who connected me to practical farmers of Iowa. It's absolutely amazing. It's a network of farmers who support and mentor you. She also has been lucky twice to find farmers who are willing to rent to her long-term, which is what she needs to be successful as an organic farmer. They understood the challenge and understood the need for real fresh food, Cahy said. Technology helps bridge gap between patients and would-be visitors by Tim Johnson, May 3rd. When Arnold Rathke of Council Bluffs was taken to Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital for hip surgery last week, his family was there. Emergency room technician Amber Hopp was also there and met them at the ambulance. She was so comforting, said his daughter Barbara Wiggins, also of Council Bluffs. But then they had to leave. Jenny, like many other hospitals currently, is not allowing visitors because of the danger of spreading the novel coronavirus. Before it was time for Rathke to have a surgery, Wiggins contacted Hop, a former co-worker of her son's, and asked how she could stay connected with her dad. "I really needed to visit with my dad and let him know that my mom was okay," Wiggins said. Said Hop, "I offered to take my phone up so she could talk to him before he went to surgery, but she didn't just let them talk to each other. Hop opened FaceTime and let them talk face to face. He grabbed my hand and got teary-eyed and said, 'Thank you so much. That made his day,' she said. It was so neat to see his face light up and her face light up." Said Wiggins, "He was elated. Just the smile on his face was so precious, and it just got me to tears. I couldn't thank her enough." So she nominated Hop for a Hidden Halo Award, one way patients and families can express their gratitude to a staff member. Such FaceTime or Skype hookups are one way the Methodist Health System is bridging the gap between visitors who can't enter the hospital right now and patients who could use a little emotional support to help them get through whatever health problems they are facing. "We are working across the health system to assist patients in connecting with their families during this non-visitor period," said Claudia Bone, Communications and Public Relations Director for Methodist Health Systems. "When the no-visitor policy was implemented, we had staff working diligently to gather iPads as well as laptops that were provided to all of our hospitals. The health system purchased iPads, and Cox Communications also purchased and donated iPads to our efforts as well. Jenny now has iPads on each floor available for staff to hold FaceTime sessions between patients and their loved ones as part of its virtual visits program. A staff member takes an iPad to the patient's room and gets the connection started for them. Not only does it connect a patient with someone who can't physically be with them, it often connects elderly, non-tech-savvy patients with a younger person who is more comfortable with technology. The iPads have also been used by our physicians to FaceTime with patients in isolation to further assist our personal protective equipment preservation efforts," said Bone. On Thursday, Jenny implemented the Health System's Pictures for Patients program. According to Tara Slevin, Director of Foundation and Volunteer Services at Jenny, the hospital has invited patients' loved ones to email treasured photos to the Methodist Jenny Edmondson Foundation, where staff members print them out and a nurse hang them up in the patient's room to remind them that their loved ones are supporting them. "The virtual visits and pictures for patients are two initiatives we hope will bring comfort and support to our patients until we are able to welcome visitors again," she said. To send a photo to a patient, email it to jefoundation@nmhs.org. Be sure to include the patient's name and room. NeighborWorks, Hammering Out Affordable Home Solutions by Tim Johnson, May 3rd. NeighborWorks Home Solution is hammering out solutions for local residents who need affordable housing. The nonprofit organization is currently building houses in several areas and is looking ahead to more construction and rehabilitation projects, according to Dave Hazelwood, Chief Operating Officer. Furthest along is a one-story home at 1806 2nd Avenue, which has already been sold, Hazelwood said. "We should be finishing that up in a couple months," he said. NeighborWorks left it up to the buyer if they wanted to add carport or a single double garage, Hazelwood said. "They would like a double garage, and that cost will be added to the home market value price of $125,000. It just had two car spots in the driveway," he said. "Just getting started, our houses at 1838 and 1842 7th Avenue, Hazelwood said. "These will be three-bedroom homes with about 12,000 square feet of living space. The house at 1838 will be a two-story structure with 1.5 baths, and the one at 1842 will be 1.5 stories with 1.75 baths. According to the listings on NP Dodge Real Estate website, both are priced at $155,000, which does not include a garage or basement. Both have large backyards with alley access. Up to $30,000 in federal down payment assistance will be available to qualified buyers of each house. It helps with closing costs and all the additional fees," he said. Meanwhile, NeighborWorks is continuing to work with several local contractors to develop the Walnut Grove subdivision at the former site of Walnut Grove Elementary School, bordered by the 29th and 30th streets between Avenues J and K, Hazelwood said. Phase one of the project, launched in August 2017, includes seven houses on Avenue J. Six of the homes have been completed and sold. NeighborWorks restored and broke ground on phase two in October 2019. As of last month, five homes have been finished and four have been sold. A house is currently under construction on the last parcel remaining in phase one and should be completed by July, he said. Construction is beginning on the two remaining lots in phase two, and one has been sold in advance. NeighborWorks is looking for more building lots in the west end of the city, said Hazelwood. Our biggest struggle right now is land acquisition, he said. The organization has made an offer on a full block, which would provide 10 building lots, Hazelwood said. The group is also looking for appropriate homes to rehab. Beyond this year, NeighborWorks is considering construction of a three-story apartment building in the 6 acres of land it owns south of its Beacon Place Apartments at 2400 South 19th Street, Hazelwood said. The facility would have units appropriate for tenants with different income levels. Iowa West Foundation commits another $500,000 to SWI COVID-19 Response Fund. Mid-American Energy pledges $25,000 to Pott County Community Foundation. By John Liu, May 3rd. The Southwest Iowa COVID-19 Response Fund, a partnership between the Iowa West Foundation and Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, continues to grow and provide for area nonprofits and their clientele affected by the pandemic. The Iowa West Foundation announced it has approved a second allocation of $500,000 to the cause for a total contribution of $1 million. The Iowa West Foundation is committed to seeing our community through during this crisis, said Pete Talupana, president and CEO. Ensuring Southwest Iowans have access to food and shelter remains our highest priority, while we also seek to stabilize the operations for our nonprofit partners during this difficult time. Recent grantees who have received support for the operations in some capacity include the Boys and Girls Club of the Midlands for $25,000, Children's Square for $28,401, Heartland Child Development Center for $11,555, Lutheran Family Services for $25,000, YMCA of Greater Omaha for $35,158, Council Buffs School Foundation for $27,000, the Performing Arts and Education Association of Southwest Iowa for $5,430. Mid-American Energy also announced its foundation will donate $25,000 to support COVID-19 response here locally. The company is awarding funds to 30 organizations throughout the region, including local food banks, community foundations, and United Way agencies addressing hunger and other urgent community needs. Nonprofits are really feeling a squeeze with the increased demands from their communities, fundraising disruptions, and challenges in getting help from volunteers due to health concerns, said Catherine Kuhner, Mid-American Energy Vice President of Economic Connections and Integration. We believe this donation will provide real help to meet these very real needs. Donna Dostal, President and CEO of the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, said the team at Mid-American Energy truly has a philanthropic heart. Throughout their CARES program, which they're making a tangible impact on our Southwest Iowa communities as we work through the challenges caused by COVID-19 crisis, she said. As a community, we are grateful for their support. Individuals, families, corporations, and others who would like to donate to the Southwest Iowa COVID-19 relief efforts are encouraged to visit ourpccf.org or call 712-256-7007. Dostal emphasized that all donations from individuals will receive a 10% match through the PCCF. The Southwest Iowa COVID-19 Response Fund also continues to accept applications, with the highest priority being emergency assistance for vulnerable populations and health and public health infrastructure. The universal application for relief funding can be found at both iowawestfoundation.org and ourpccf.org. That's ourpccf.org. Burglary suspect shot after confrontation with Council Bluffs police officer by Susan Payne, May 3rd. An officer was involved in a shooting at Bucky's Express in Council Bluffs after responding to a report of theft at the gas station Saturday morning. At 8 a.m., a Council Bluffs police officer arrived at the gas station on 3434 Nebraska Avenue. He was informed by an employee that a man had allegedly stolen a gas can from the business, valued at $13.99. According to a release from the police department, the officer allegedly confronted the man at the front of the business, police said. The suspect, identified as Jimmy Carr, 34 of Omaha, allegedly reached into his pocket for a gun that he then displayed and fired, police said. The officer returned fire, striking Carr in his left hip area, the police said. He was arrested and taken to the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries, police said. Police said no one else was injured during the incident. The department will release the name of the officer at a later date, according to the release. The ongoing investigation will be conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department jointly with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations. Anyone with information about this incident is encouraged to contact the Council Bluffs Police Criminal Investigations Division at 712-328-4728 or call Crime Stoppers at 712-328-7867. Iowa couple in their 80s survived coronavirus in time for their 70th wedding anniversary by Christopher Burbach, May 2nd. An Iowa couple almost 90 years old have survived life-threatening coronavirus infections just in time for their 70th wedding anniversary. Artis McCandless, 89, and the younger man she married in 1950, Burke McCandless, contracted COVID-19 in March and were hospitalized at Creighton University Medical Center, Bergen-Mercy. Artis didn't have it as bad as Burke, who's 88. She spent 3 days in the hospital in late March. He went into the hospital on April 1st in shock and barely alive. The doctors estimated that he had a 10% to 20% chance of surviving. Burt was on a ventilator for more than 2 weeks, but on April 24th, Burt returned to the couple's home in Whiting, Iowa, where Artis was happy to see him. She sat on his lap. "She hasn't done that in 30 years," Burt said, "so I must be a hot commodity. I hugged him and kissed him and cried, and I have a picture of me lying across his lap," Artis said, laughing. "Just to be clear," she added, "we had our clothes on." By Friday, the lively couple were back in their home, little ranch house in small northwestern Iowa town of Whiting, watching the birds through the dining room window and looking forward to getting back to gardening, quilting, and visits from their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They're still recovering, especially Bert, but it looks like by summer he'll be able to make his daily rounds of senior centers, coffee shops, and bars to give away the vegetables he grows for fun. That's a lot better than the outlook for most of the spring. The novel coronavirus has hit older people a lot harder than younger people. It has been particularly dangerous for people over 85. A study released in mid-April, as reported in the Washington Post, found a death rate of 40% among people 85 and older who had been hospitalized with COVID-19 in the U.S. Even among relatively healthy people without comorbidities, like the McCandlesses, the death rate in the study was still 22 to 27%. Artis McCandless contracted it first. The couple's older daughter, Terry Schaff, is pretty sure that they got it from her and that she picked it up on a trip to the Ozarks in mid-March, just before the cases started to be reported in the Midwest. Artis went to the clinic in Onawa, Iowa. She was turning blue, so on March 25th, she was sent by an ambulance to Bergen-Mercy. The family had an affinity for the Omaha hospital because of Bert's successful heart bypass surgery there a couple of decades ago. Artis was able to go home on March 28th, but Bert's cough and other symptoms worsened. He too went to the hospital in Onawa. He was in dire condition by the time the ambulance took him to Omaha on April 1st. He's no recollection of the more than 2 weeks going back to before the trip to Omaha. Dr. Brian Krajicek, a CHI physician who was involved in Bert's care, can fill in some of the blanks. He said Bert was in shock and already intubated, requiring a ventilator, when he arrived at Bergen-Mercy. He was in our ICU for over 2 weeks, requiring really every bit of critical care support that we could provide to him in the ICU, Krajicek said. Mechanical ventilation, he required neuromuscular paralysis, which is something we do to kind of limit the body's oxygen needs and improve his interactions with the ventilator. They also used medicine to keep Bert's tanking blood pressure up. They periodically proned him or turned him over on his stomach to optimize his lungs' oxygen uptake and protect his lungs, a practice that has shown to reduce mortality in such patients, Krajicek said. An 88-year-old guy who is that sick, his predicted mortality would be 80 to 90% or beyond, he quite honestly said. He said, the team of doctors and nurses provided that Krajicek called an evidence-based standard of care to keep Bert alive until his body could fight off the virus. He did not receive convalescent plasma or remdesivir, as some coronavirus patients do. Krajicek attributed Bert's survival to such care as the team's careful management of ventilator pressure and fluid intake, as well as to Bert's physical condition coming in. According to Bert, the first doctor he talked to after waking up put it this way: "You're one tough son of a bitch." Bert said he was grateful to the Bergen Mercy doctors, especially the nurses who took care of him. His daughter thinks that hard work in the garden is something to do with his survival. Last summer, he would have been 87. He'd be out working in the garden, sweating his butt off all day, and he'd come in and change his clothes and go back out later, Terry said. The couple live within a couple miles of the farm where they raised Terry and their son, Dennis, along with corn, beans, and livestock. Artis worked as a postmaster for 30 years. The couple traveled a lot, once taking their grandchildren on a road trip to Alaska. Bert had been around the world 3 times with his buddy, Gene Simpson of Omaha, who owned an aircraft sales company. Bert and another friend built an outboard motorboard from a kit and piloted it from Ottawa down the Missouri and Mississippi rivers all the way to New Orleans in 1958. Now Bert makes daily rounds of senior centers, coffee shops, and bars to play pool and have a pop. He doesn't drink. They have more than a dozen grandchildren and great-grandchildren and catch a lot of their ball games. Artis works in the flower garden and sews quilts, including with a group of friends at the library in Whiting. She has 27 quilts in a show last fall, including her favorite, a wall and stack with southwestern colors. "We'll never freeze to death," she quipped. The couple were high school sweethearts in Whiting. Artis dumped Bert after they graduated, but she let him know that she would like to see him again, and they were married in a small ceremony in Whiting on October 6, 1950. They don't have big plans for the 70th anniversary. Artis doesn't like a lot of fuss. "I'll look at her," Bert said, "and she'll look at me." Grajicic said, "We've had a few really good outcomes that we're really proud of. To have a 70th wedding anniversary to celebrate at the end of this recovery is just remarkable. It's stories like these that certainly make for a good day." Comments sought on state plan for $97 million in recovery funds for 2019 flooding by John Liu, May 2nd. The Iowa Economic Development Authority has announced the availability of Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Action Plan. The additional Supplemental Appropriations for Disaster Relief Act, passed by Congress, allocated $96,741,000 to the state of Iowa for the purpose of assisting in long-term recovery from the major flooding disaster that took place in the spring of 2019. The action plan details how the Iowa Economic Development Authority plans to expend the CDBGDR allocation. The public is encouraged to comment through 4:30 p.m. on June 1st. The report may be obtained and comments accepted via the internet at iowaeconomicdevelopment.com/our-agency-detail-resources/6501 or by contacting Ann Schmid, Disaster Recovery Team Leader, IEDA, 1963 Bell Avenue, Des Moines, 50315, or by email at ann.schmid@iowaeda.com or by phone at 515-348-6202. In addition, a virtual public hearing will be held starting at 2:30 p.m. on May 20th, 2020. Please contact Ann Schmid at the email or phone number above to request a call-in number. The purpose of these public hearing will be to receive public comments on the plan. The state of Iowa's draft plan to use the Federal Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery funding can be viewed online. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, May 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines. I'm Grace from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. May 2nd obituaries. Frank Jerkovich. Frank George Jerkovich, age 83, of Council Bluffs, passed away on April 29, 2020 at CHI Mercy Hospital. Frank was born in Council Bluffs on November 3, 1936 to the late Charles and Mary Jerkovich, who graduated from Abraham Lincoln College in 1955. He was united in marriage to Linda Smith on May 11, 1958. Frank worked several years as a switchman for the Union Pacific Railroad. He was an avid golfer, horse racing fan, mushroom hunter, former youth wrestling coach, where he took many kids to Tulsa Olympics. Frank loved his dogs and cats and watching his kids and grandkids' activities. Frank is preceded in death by his parents, son Chuck in 2016, brothers Charles and John, sisters Anne Haney and Helen Hartman. Survivors include his wife of 62 years, Linda, daughters Joan Broche of Omaha, Nebraska, Jacques Jerkovich, and their dog Finn, Margie Johnson and husband Greg, all of Council Bluffs, daughter-in-law Christy L. Jerkovich, 8 grandchildren, his 3 great-grandchildren, sisters Mary Sell and husband Floyd of Omaha, Lucille Mead and husband Don of Omaha, Margie Stiles and husband Mike of Council Bluffs, special nephew John Jerkovich, many other nieces, nephews, and friends. Open visitation Sunday 2 to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel with COVID-19 restrictions in place. Private family funeral on Monday with interment at Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Family will direct memorial. Family funeral service will be live streamed at 11 a.m. on Monday on the funeral home's website. Sunday, May 3rd, obituaries. Anne Vermillion. Anne Elizabeth Worthman Fox Vermillion, age 72 of Council Bluffs, passed away on April 29, 2020, after enjoying many happy years of life. In addition to her husband, Keith Vermillion, Anna survived by her sons, Todd Fox and his wife, April, Todd's children, Zoe and Adam, Tony Fox and his wife, Christy, and their children, Gaston, Garen, and Gannon, her five brothers and their spouses, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Anne was a daughter of the late Ralph and Elizabeth Worthman. She was born on August 17, 1947 in Prosser, Washington, and was the only daughter of 6 children. She dearly loved all of her brothers, Ralph, also known as Ozzie, John, William, also known as Bill, Steve, and Mark. Early on, the family moved back to Omaha, Nebraska. Anne attended St. Bernard's Catholic School, and in 1965, graduated from Marion High School with honors. In 1968, she graduated from Wayne State College with a BA in elementary education. That spring, she married Ron Fox and they moved to Akron, Iowa, where they both taught school. In 1972, they moved to Council Bluffs. Anne went on to earn her Master's of Science in Education from the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and eventually earned her Educational Doctorate in Curriculum and Instruction. She used her education in her 29 years of service to the Council Bluffs Community Schools in various roles such as Director of Chapter 1 Reading, Director of Early Childhood Education, Grant Writing, Even Start, and at different times, Principal of 3 different schools. She and Ron divorced in 1997, but she found love again in the form of a handsome neighbor, Keith Vermillion. They were married in 2000 and shared their love of adventure and travel into their retirement years. Visitation and funeral mass will be held at a later date with interment in the Resurrection Cemetery, Omaha. And now to sports. Quarantine Cup gives some Hawkeye 10 conference athletes competitive outlet by Derek Noren, May 3rd. You never know when inspiration will strike. Dan Vargason teaches Spanish at Atlantic High School while also coaching cross country, girls basketball, and JV girls soccer. In the absence of school-sanctioned spring sports, Vargason wanted to find a way to give kids an athletic outlet. During this time of COVID-19 and shelter in place, he got an idea from a popular quarantine pastime, watching movies. Before they put all the restrictions, we were discussing schedule all our own soccer games and going to the club route if we had to. Once they started placing all the restrictions, it was clear no one was going to be able to go out and do much. I just started trying to think of anything we could do, Vargason said. This is kind of funny, but one night before bed, I was watching Billy Madison. When he challenges Eric to the academic decathlon, I was like, why don't we just come up with 10 events for sports? It was some brainstorming and then an aha moment with none other than Billy Madison. And thus, thanks in part to Adam Sandler, the Quarantine Cup had life. The next step was seeing if other schools in the Hawkeye 10 conference would be interested. It's varied. Some schools in the Hawkeye 10 have made an administrative decision to not participate, but the majority are getting involved, Vargason said. Lewis Central, St. Alberta, Atlantic, Comper Catholic, Harlan are some that have been blowing up the Twitter account and sending me messages and email, making sure everything is good to go. We set up Zoom meetings with the coaches to organize events. It was good to see the other Hawkeye 10 coaches helping with this. Once enough activities directors, coaches, and athletes showed interest, Vargason started organizing things to get and getting help from coaches with the event. While Ferguson had ideas for soccer, he wanted to let coaches in the other sports develop their own game plan. While the track events, like the 100-meter dash, were pretty straightforward, golf, tennis, and soccer had to get more creative. Lewis Central tennis coach Aaron Rodenberg jumped at the chance to help. "I think it's important to participate anytime the conference is competing," Rodenberg said. "I have children of my own, and I know that a kid needs something to do right now." It was also an opportunity to introduce some quick and easy drills kids can do to work on rudimentary skills. In tennis, one of the events was trying to make layups in a basketball hoop with a tennis ball and racket, while another challenged players to alternate between backhand and forehand grips. Soccer tasked competitors in juggling, accuracy shooting, and throw-in distance. In golf, there was a bucket, chipping, putting, and flop shot event. "Most people could get to a track, but some schools are completely shut down, and we get that," Ferguson said. "We suggested going out and marking off 100 meters for track. We tried to come up with things that were simple enough, but when you're trying to come up with 10 events, you have to get a little bit more creative." This week was the first of the competition, which will continue on a weekly basis until May 15th, with results being submitted at the end of each week. All four spring sports, track, golf, tennis, and soccer, will each have 10 events. Boys and girls teams will compete against other conference teams, with championships crowned at the end. "While it's not ideal," Ferguson said, This is when we need sports the most. "Isn't overcoming adversity all what sports is about?" he said. For more information on the Quarantine Cup, visit @QuarantineCup10 on Twitter. Coach's Journal. Lewis Central's Matt Argestinger. May 2nd. Matt Argestinger is the boys' track and field coach at Lewis Central. "Usually, at this time in the track season, we are just getting done with Drake. This year would have been a special one, as we have one of the best, if not the best, thrower in the state. He won't be able to accomplish his goal of winning a double at Drake this year. That being said, he hasn't complained once about it. He is just one athlete of our large senior class that did and would have accomplished even more great things on the track. The worst part for them is that we are just finishing up our hardest workouts for the year. Logan Jones, Logan Carpenter, Kale Boltman, Connor Lanchel, Easton Dermody, Brady Miller, Adam Mortensen, Zach McDaniel, and Josh Sell are all seniors who won't get to compete one last time. I feel the worst for the ones who haven't had a chance to go to the state track meet, which is where these guys would have ended up, either as competitor or alternative. We always try to get our seniors there. In the end, these guys will be very successful, because here is what they are going to do next year. 4 of them are going to be college athletes. The other 4 are going to study pre-med, mechanical engineering, mathematics, meteorology, and 1 will be joining the military's intelligence division. I couldn't be more proud of these boys. I personally miss my coworkers, my fellow teachers at the middle school, and my 2 assistants, Taylor May and Vince Rue. They make the season fun every year. Mostly, I miss teaching, coaching, and being around the kids. They are the reason I love coaching so much and get excited every season. Just knowing that track and other sports will be there when all of this is over is one of the things that gets me through this crazy time. AL Coach Teaches Student Athletes Lessons on Life and Leadership by Patrick Donahue. Updated May 3rd. Since March, education and athletics around the country are operating under a new normal. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, in-person classes are no longer possible. As a result, innovation is necessary in order for high schools to continue to provide students with lessons in life and sports. J.C. Stratton has helped spearhead that charge at Abraham Lincoln. A college student and junior varsity volleyball and freshman girls basketball coach, Stratton has organized virtual student gatherings that teach her pupils leadership skills that are valuable in both life and athletics. Stratton, a Mobile native, organizes Google Hangout sessions that are aimed to teach students at a young age the importance of leadership. There are Q&A sessions, general discussions, daily challenges, and simple tasks that Stratton puts together tailored towards leadership in daily life and in the sports world. Additionally, guest speakers are used weekly. Guests have included former Daily Nonpareil City Girls Athlete of the Year, Kylie Ferguson from St. Alberta, and Kiana Phelps, a thrower for the University of Oregon track and field team who won state championships in both the discus and shot put while at Kingsley Pearson High School in Kingsley. "I want to help my athletes whichever way I can, whether it's with skill development or leadership," Stratton said. "Whatever it is, I just want to find something for all of these athletes that maybe I wish I would have had to become a better teammate, a better leader. and not just with sports, within the school, within the community. These are skills that I think are important, and if we can work on developing those earlier, it's going to be helpful for the kids. To date, the virtual meetings have been attended by AL students only, but Stratton said anyone interested in attending is invited. Meetings typically are held Mondays at 10 a.m. The time can be subject to change depending on the schedule of the speaker. It's best to check Stratton's Twitter handle, @coach_Stratton3, for any changes or updates to the schedule. Being an athlete isn't a requirement either. Anyone is welcome. It's an interesting time, but I think it's a blessing, Stratton said. Some of my athletes that I try to stay in contact with now, as well myself, are finding things to do that we maybe didn't make time for previously. I've encouraged my athletes to find something new, pick up a new skill. If you go out and go for a run, train so you can run for distance. If you want to take up yoga, practice yoga, find something you like, give it a shot, and see what comes of it. Stratton has been pleased with the response to the meetings so far. She hopes to continue with similar lessons once students return to school. Really, COVID-19 and Twitter got it going. Now that it's going, I'm looking to keep building, she said. The kids have been great. They've been really receptive. They've been really interactive. They get reflection questions with the speakers. The feedback from them has been amazing. They've been enjoying it. And now back to news. Volunteers needed for 2020 Clean Sweep event being held now through May 12th. Updated May 2nd. Help beautify the city for spring by picking up litter around the community during the 9th annual Clean Sweep event. This event, organized by the 712 Initiative and the Council Bluffs Recycling Center, gathers volunteers from around the city and assigns them sections of the community to clean up. While past Clean Sweep events have consisted of one-day volunteer effort followed by live music and dinner in Bayless Park, this 2020 event has shifted due to the current COVID-19 situation. Instead of a single-day event, the 712 Initiative has expanded the Clean Sweep to fit social distancing expectations. This social distancing edition of Clean Sweep launched on Earth Day and will go through May 2nd or May 12th. Volunteers now have the option to choose whether they would like to clean their own neighborhood streets or a predetermined community area that is typically assigned to a group during the Clean Sweep. Community members are encouraged to sign up at the712initiative.org/cleansweepvolunteer. This is a great way to get outside and help your community while social distancing, said Rachel Kent, Marketing and Public Relations Coordinator for the 712 Initiative. There may not be an after party for Clean Sweep this year, but we hope that that won't keep volunteers from making a difference in their community. Last year, volunteers cleaned up a record 3,920 pounds of litter around the Council Bluffs community. The 712 Initiative can provide cleanup materials to volunteers if needed. Contact jsnow@the712initiative.org to make arrangements to get gloves and trash bags. Please consider Midlands Humane Society during Omaha and Potawatomi Gives by Corey Nelson, May 2nd. Since its launch in 2013, Omaha Gives has three primary goals: to engage a new audience of donors, to build capacity for local nonprofit organizations, and to bring the community together around giving. In 2019, this event continued to show consistency with previous Omaha Gives days. Consider this: almost one-third of donations were first-time gifts, and 88% of the total donations were gifts of $100 or less. Just in case you weren't completely familiar with Omaha Gives, here's the Cliff Notes version. Omaha Gives, organized through the Omaha Community Foundation, having recently partnered with Potawatomi Gives through the Potawatomi County Community Foundation, started as a 24-hour online fundraising event to raise support for nonprofits in Douglas, Sarpy, and Potawatomi counties. It is a community-wide event to show off the area's spirit of giving, raise awareness about local nonprofits, and celebrate the collective effort it takes to make this community. It has grown to become a longer giving initiative now beginning on May 1st. Here's an amazing statistic. Since 2013, this community give-together has raised $49 million for more than 1,000 nonprofits. Last year alone, there were 18,612 donors, giving a record 48,661 donations, meaning that we have some very kind-hearted people giving to the several charities. In the past, the minimum online donation started at $10 and increased from there. This year, that minimum donation has been lowered to $1 in hopes that more and more people can consider themselves a philanthropist and help charities that are near and dear to their hearts. There are other ways nonprofits can bolster their earnings, such as $48,000 given out as hourly drawings, where each hour during the 24-hour main giving period on May 20th, two organizations will be randomly selected to receive an additional $1,000. There will also be $45,000 awarded in participation prizes given to nonprofits who attract the highest number of donors and will be awarded during these 8-hour time periods throughout the day, midnight to 8 a.m., 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., and 4 p.m. to midnight. There are some additional prizes that MHS is eligible for because we are located in Pottawatomie County. The Midlands Humane Society is incredibly pleased to announce that we have established challenge funds this year in the amount of $5,000 thanks to some generous donors. We are hopeful to be able to match that amount, raising at least $10,000 to help animals in need. Remember, we don't just provide basic care for animals that find their way to our door. There are often cases where we go above and beyond to provide or arrange for top-notch medical care, consisting of dental procedures, eye and jaw surgeries, healing skin and allergy conditions, and sometimes amputations when necessary. We ask for your generosity in giving this year. COVID-19 has altered how we operate, and our community has been amazing and patient and adopted out so many animals. One of the biggest adjustments we have made was moving our largest annual fundraiser, 2020 Vision, formerly known as the Derby, from May 8th to September 18th. The location remains at the Mid-America Center, with doors opening at 5 p.m. Please go online to MidlandsHumaneSociety.org to register to attend this event and hop onto www.omahagives.org to set up your financial gift for Omaha Gives / Pottawatomie Gives. The MHS Pets of the Week are Mavis, a 3-year-old female American Bulldog who arrived as a stray. Sweet Mavis was running loose for about 2 months before finally being trapped. Despite this, she is a loving dog with a huge heart. She can be very slow to warm up and needs time to trust people. Once she does, she will try to get in your lap and loves to run zoomies. She will do best in a low-key home where she can acclimate to her own space. She'd be best in a home with patient children at least 10 years old. She doesn't seem to like very active or playful dogs, but may do well with other calm dogs or would be happiest as your only dog. Mufasa is a 4-year-old domestic shorthair who would do best in a home without dogs. Bessie is an 8-year-old female domestic shorthair who arrived as a stray. Stuart is a 1-year-old neutered male Chihuahua beagle mix, and he is the life of the party. This guy has plenty of energy and is looking for someone who can keep up. Stuart seems to be a social butterfly who likes everyone he meets. However, he can get overwhelmed with too much commotion. While we think he would love a home with another playful dog, we recommend kids 10 or older and recognize when he needs a break. We are open today from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Please call to make an appointment. We continue to require appointments for activity, so please call 712-396-2270 for assistance. Solus has 3 adult cats seeking forever homes by Mary Jones, May 2nd. Support our local animal shelters hopes that everyone is staying healthy and is enjoying time with their human families and their fur babies. Our adorable tiger is 9.5-year-old tabby cat who was born on September 17, 2010. She's a petite sweetie who is very quiet, super affectionate, plus loves to cuddle. Tiger has already been spayed and is very careful to keep her claws retracted. She doesn't get along with dogs, but she gets along great with adults and children. She insists on a clean litter box, and she'll be very vocal if you forget to keep it clean. For some unknown reason, she enjoys licking tape and marshmallows. Our Lily is a 9-pound Russian blue. She is highly intelligent, soft-spoken, very intelligent, plus she loves to play. Lily has already been spayed, plus she likes to keep her claws retracted. For some unknown reason, she doesn't like dogs, but she is great with children and adults. Her favorite things to do are playing with yarn, watch birds through the window, and climb on her cat tower. Lily and Tiger have been inseparable since birth, and they must be adopted together. Bandit was born May 11, 2016. He was just a week old when he was found in a barn. He was a bottle baby and a bit quirky, thanks to being raised by humans. Bandit loves to be petted on his head, but not on his back or stomach. He's very talkative and loves to snuggle on people while he contently purrs. He desires to be the center of attention and he'll put on a show for entertainment. Bandit enjoys dogs, likes yogurt, and really loves playing hockey on the floor with an ice cube. Plus, he's great at keeping his claws retracted. Bandit loves climbing his cat tower and taking cat naps in the sun. Are you looking for the perfect kitten or cat and just haven't found it yet? Please give Solus a call at 402-968-4000. 0822 and our volunteers will find you that perfect purring someone for you. Hashtag Giving Tuesday Now, a rallying movement to support the community, submitted by Share Omaha, the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, and the Omaha Community Foundation, May 3rd. What does generosity look like in these days? With news swirling and cautions rampant for preventing the spread of COVID-19, it's tempting to retreat to our homes in isolation, only focused on our own needs. However, that is not the Council Bluffs Omaha Metro way. Our community cares. This is our time to come together for the causes who support our more vulnerable neighbors and missions that strengthen the Metro. The outpouring of support began one day. Over 700 Metro neighbors submitted interest for volunteering on Share Omaha's website in April. The public is supporting the Omaha Community Foundation's and Pottawatomie County Community Foundation's pandemic funds to address local gaps and needs. Blood donations and delivery of gifted items and donations to help the Food Bank for the Heartland and local food pantries were among the first ways our residents sprang into action. We know that local organizations will feel the harsh realities and effects of the pandemic for a long time to come. Nonprofit Association of the Midlands conducted a pulse survey of 505 nonprofit leaders, and 56 reported COVID-19 will have significant impact on their programs, services, or general operations. This survey reflects canceled events leading to a loss in revenue which can't be made up, an increase in services for some nonprofits without having secured additional funding, and concerns regarding fundraising and how to keep doors open now with an uncertain economy. The metro area will look different after the crisis dissipates, but it doesn't have to be without services, amenities, and attractions that define our city's character. Nonprofit organizations have shown great ingenuity and innovation to continue to deliver or pivot services over the past 2 months. They will continue to deliver on mission and strive for impact. That is what the very nature of nonprofit workforce. Our community contributes. The work we needed to transform the ability for local causes to do good has begun. On Tuesday, the Council Bluffs Omaha Metro will have the opportunity to join a global response to the pandemic. Hashtag Giving Tuesday Now. As Omaha Gives opened for donation on May 1st, hashtag Giving Tuesday Now is our time to donate and to volunteer for nonprofit organizations. Our entire area can come up together to lift each other up and overcome isolation with our acts of good. Let's unite our neighborhood to give as we can throughout May, so that May 20th is not the only an Omaha Gives / Pottawatomie Gives celebration, but a source of much needed funding. This is a rallying moment for the causes you support. Share Omaha, the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, and the Omaha Community Foundation are devoted to seeing the nonprofit organizations of the Metro succeed and connect to meaningful support, especially now. We're united in stoking that fire and doing and giving good. May will be an incredible month. Don't miss the opportunity for helping that will warm, spread, and grow. Let us see what we can do together as we dually move through this crisis and find an opportunity to support one another. This is who we are. We show up, we raise our hands, and we give. History we live in. Dutch colonial home once owned by Judge up for National Registry. By Mary Lou McGinn, Preserve Council Bluffs. May 3rd. 412 South 8th Street. Judge Egbert E. Aylesworth. This relatively unchanged Dutch colonial house was built circa 1891 for Judge Egbert Aylesworth, who practiced law in Council Bluffs more than 40 years, except for 12 years on the bench. Judge Aylesworth was born in 1838 in Milford, New York, and descended one of the old New England families. His father, Benjamin Aylesworth, was born in 1791 in Pownell, Vermont, and moved to Milford, where he farmed and where his son John and grandson Egbert were born. Egbert received his primary education in Milford, attended Hartwick Seminary in Otsego, New York, and completed his studies at Delaware Literary Institute in Franklin, New York in 1860. He returned to Milford, where he studied law and was admitted to the bar in 1863. He continued to practice law there for the next 3 years. On September 20th, 1864, he married Marcella Windsor, a native of Otsego County. Egbert and Marcella moved to Council Bluffs in 1866, where he opened an office and practiced law for the next 40 years, except for his years as a Superior Court judge. He was elected to the position of city attorney in 1874 and again in 1876, serving all 4 years. In March of 1882, he was elected judge of the Superior Court and remained on the bench for 12 years, according to H.H. Field's History of Pottawatomie County. He retired in 1894 from that position and returned to private practice. Judge Aylesworth served on the council, on the City Council and the Board of Education. He was an active member of the Elks and the Eagles. He and Marcella were members of the Episcopal Church. They had three sons and one daughter. Aylesworth occupied several homes in the South 8th Street neighborhood. The house around the corner at 812 Fifth Avenue was built for Judge Aylesworth in 1874 and later became the home of Sheriff James O'Neill, featured in this column on October 11, 2015. The nationwide depression of 1893 to 1898 brought economic upheaval across the country. The Aylesworth lost property at 412 South 8th Street, where they had built that new house in 1891, twice during the 1890s, and Marcella bought it back in 1899. They're last listed in the city's directory in 1911. They moved back to their home in Milford, where the Judge Aylesworth died in 1918 and Marcella in 1924. They're buried in Pine Grove Cemetery in Milford. The recent South 8th Street survey describes the house as an unusual side-gabled Dutch colonial style resting on a rock-faced brick foundation, clad in narrow clapboarding siding on the first story and masonite or similar hardboard siding on the second story, possibly replacing the original wood shingle siding. Its gambrel roof is covered in composition shingles. An unusual feature for the house is use of close eaves in the gambrel ends. The first story of the front east facade has recessed entry to the north and a shallow three-sided cutaway window to the south. Two gabled roof dormers are located in the front facade. The post railing and the deck of the porch are modern. The nomination concludes that the house retains essential features identifying it as an early 20th century Dutch colonial revival style residence. The South 8th Street district nomination has been submitted and is in process of applying for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, May 4th. And may the 4th be with you. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Grace from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. The winter solstice is the shortest day and the longest night of the year. It's been celebrated by cultures around the world since our earliest history. The winter solstice comes on or around December 21st and 6 months later in the Southern Hemisphere. Leading up to it, the days appear to be dying. The dawn comes later, the sunset earlier. Nights get longer and colder. In far northern and southern latitudes, this is very keenly felt. Then, on the solstice, things turn around. The day after is a little longer, and they keep getting lighter and brighter. So the solstice has always been associated with rebirth of the sun and of a new year. Asian, Middle Eastern, North and South American cultures all had, and still have, festivals marking the rebirth of the sun. The Romans, too, celebrated Saturnalia, dedicated to the sun god Saturn, characterized by charity and gift-giving. In the 4th century, when they converted to Christianity, they turned their festival of the sun's rebirth into a celebration of a different sun's birth. This gave us Christmas on December 25th. Later, when the Vikings became Christians, they brought Nordic solstice traditions, evergreen trees, holly, and mistletoe, all symbols of life in the dark winter. So this holiday season, you might consider a solstice party. It's the astronomically correct way to ring out the old year and welcome the birth of the new. I'm Scott Tinker with Glad Tidings on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.